ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, Sarah Kanoski here. I recently sat down for a conversation with the former Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern. We talked about her upbringing as a good Mormon girl, her unusual path into political leadership, and how she navigated some of the most terrible events in the history of New Zealand.
I felt such rage that part of the way they designed this horrific attack was to try and get people to react violently.
Hear my conversation with Jacinda Ardern now by searching for Conversations on the ABC Listen app.
Can Britain be saved? Has it become ungovernable?
Gee, that sounds like classic British self-flagellation, Hamish, but it's not the full story, I can tell you, having just been there.
Yes, welcome back from your big trip, Jerry. Should we talk about that or some global politics?
Just the odd bit of global politics. Certainly watching the UK rethink leadership, fascinating.
I'm Hamish McDonald.
And I'm Geraldine Doogue. Today on Global Roaming, can Britain's new PM turn that country round?
I have just come from Buckingham Palace, where I have accepted His Majesty the King's invitation to form a government.
Jerry, wonderful to have you back. Good to see you.
Yes, it's terrific to be back. I'm sort of settling back.
We're going to get to the UK, but you've had quite a trip.
I have. It was a trip essentially to Eastern and Central Europe. I'm talking about Poland, Lithuania, Hungary, Austria, which I hadn't really gone to a lot. I mean, I've sort of skirted. And it was a very different experience to going.
Can we be honest with listeners? You went on a NATO tour. Like an actual NATO tour for your holiday.
Well, it wasn't actually authorised by NATO. It was people who were very happy to talk to all sorts of people. I was briefed about the role of NATO, just the sort of nearness to Russia. History is always there, if you know what I mean, in a way that we don't experience here in Australia. And we went right up to the border between Russia, the long border between Russia and Belarus, which is a satellite of Russia. So you do have to keep your head about you. But I suppose going there, going right onto the border, seeing the two gigantic fences that they are still constructing to stop the Belarusians weaponizing asylum seekers to come through and destabilize Poland en route to Germany. So, I mean, and we saw the infrared cameras showing this. It was quite extraordinary. I mean, it was proof. And we also sort of met the generals in the tanks, you know, in the NATO eastern flank. So you sort of see a preparation for war that honestly I certainly hadn't seen before.
We need to talk about Andy Burnham.
Oh, yes, we do.
The UK's new Prime Minister. What is it, the seventh in a decade?
Mm.
Now, a few years ago, in the wake of the Manchester terror attack. Do you remember the Ariana Grande?
I certainly do.
I got sent to do a foreign correspondent episode and I met this man, Andy Burnham, who I had seen as a minister in the Blair and the Gordon Brown governments, and he'd returned to Manchester and become the mayor. And there was a lot of talk at this time in the way, because he sort of stood up and delivered as the mayor of a big city in the wake of those attacks in a way that I think caught people's eye. And people were saying, look, he's gone back to base, but he'll eventually come back to be Prime Minister. And I was pretty doubtful. I was pretty sceptical and, you know, spent a bit of time with him for this foreign correspondent episode. I didn't really see it, but here we are.
Yes, I wondered, you know, I just kept hearing both in the lead up when we were talking about this before I went away and then in, you know, Andy Burnham. I thought, who is this bloke? I mean, I hadn't had the luxury of what you'd been through. See, he actually has had more experience. He ran for the leadership of the Labor Party in 2010 and in 2015 after Gordon Brown lost office and when there was all that debate between the Miliband brothers and he lost. I mean, I think he came third and he obviously went away and regrouped. So look, I'm waiting to see. There's an enormous amount of hope invested in him, but also people over there from all sides of the political spectrum saying, be bold, man, be bold. Burn off some of your supporters. You've got to do it for the sake of Britain. Now, will that happen?
Let's get into it. Ben Wellings is Associate Professor in Politics and International Relations at Monash and the author of English Nationalism and British Disintegration. Hey, Ben, welcome to Global Roaming.
Hello, Hamish.
Britain's a mess. Can Andy Burnham fix it?
Well, that's a big question, isn't it? Will a change of manager manage turn things around, or are the structural problems simply too deep? Of course, Australia's been here before, and so we know that a change of government and a change of personnel can make a difference. It's just a question of whether there are some extra things about the UK, I think, that are different to Australia when it was going through its leadership turmoil that may be a little bit different. And that, of course, is the long-term effects of austerity. That's been around for about 16 years, and the kind of lack of government spending on services. But obviously, the economic effects of Brexit and the depressing of the UK economy that has had.
The comparison with Australia's period of revolving prime ministers is often made, but I actually reckon the better comparison is Italy, that Britain has now become Italy. And I reckon it's a better comparison because I think that the underlying factors of kind of economic malaise, a loss of direction in terms of national identity, are far more akin to what was going on in Italy at that period. Obviously, Giorgia Meloni now very much in charge, and they're enjoying political stability and economic growth. What do you think?
Yeah, and this is a good comparison too. Sometimes Britain now gets referred to as Brittany for that reason. And it talks to changing voter loyalties. And this is something that we see across all liberal democracies. In the UK's case, Brexit has exacerbated this and put it into two competing tribes that have divergent views on Britain's place in Europe and the world. But I think in the Italian case, the strains of the post-pandemic government and, as you say, a kind of a rise of nativist opinion certainly seems to be where Italian politics has ended up. So, yeah, it's a good comparison. Whether Burnham is the new Meloni, I mean, they're very different politically, you know, and ideologically speaking, is more of a moot point, I think.
This sort of awful phrase that has come in, and I think you have alluded to it, Ben, is, you know, is Britain ungovernable? Like, this is the classic thing that flashes over the screen in England, you know, oh, let's flagellate ourselves even more. And then people, you know, like Sir Anthony Seldon and Sir John Curtis say, no, it's not. It's just got to be governed better. And it just seems to me, I don't want to buy into this idea that it is ungoverned, because I actually don't think that's true.
I reckon there's a structural question there, but maybe we should let Ben speak.
Yes, what do you think about this, Ben?
Well, I think words and rhetoric do matter in a leader. And I suppose the comparison in Australia, Howard and Albanese are not kind of wordsmiths, are they? But they've got something that they managed to bring stability and order to government. I think you're right that unfortunately Keir Starmer was not the person to narrate British politics at this particular time. And I think if any government goes in maybe trying to be honest with the electorate, saying things are going to be pretty tough, you've got to kind of temper that a little bit with some vision. And I think that maybe Starmer was a little too managerial. So you can already see in Burnham that there's a little bit more hope creeping into this.
Well, as you say, hope is what kills you looking at the England football.
Yeah, right. You know, so you can't, you're laying a trap for yourself if you overdo it and it doesn't resonate with people's experience. And so I think that's why, you know, doing things like, you know, very visible and symbolic things like trying to end rough sleeping, which is sort of the first sort of policy announcement from outside 10 Downing Street in London. But I think Hamish is probably going to allude to, well, you know, that's all well and good, but if the whole thing is fractured in a way that people are not used to, and we could just be getting used to something new, it might be beyond the capabilities of anyone. But I tend to think the claims about ungovernability, which were around in the 70s as well, have some sort of political intent, and, you know, they're not necessarily an objective description of what's going on, but, you know, they're designed to kind of undermine the people who are currently in charge as well. So I think that things are new and different, but I don't know if that equates to being ungovernable.
Yeah, okay, I'm going to make the case for the ungovernable claim here, right? Because I do think there's a few structural issues about the way Britain is governed today. First being unelected House of Lords and the fact that there is not a democratically elected oversight chamber in the parliament. And so I think it's very difficult for mandate to be delivered through that process. You know, obviously Australian listeners may not be across the fact that the government of the day, as well as the opposition, they just appoint members of the House of Lords when the positions come up. And then there are people that have the hereditary peerages that just sit there for literally their entire lives. Some of them do turn up, some of them don't. They fall asleep. I think it's a core and fundamental problem of democratic accountability in the UK today. So when you get a government that's not doing its job in Australia, you might get the upper house holding it to account or tempering its worst instincts. The other part of this is devolution. It's uneven, it's unprincipled, it's not delivering.
Unprincipled?
Well, what's the principle by which you deliver devolution to Wales and Scotland, but then not other parts of the United Kingdom? I think Andy Burnham, coming from Manchester to Downing Street, promising a sort of a Downing Street of the North, speaks to the fact that some of the most disadvantaged parts of the UK don't have similar types of representation. And so I think this goes to the very heart of the claim of Britain being ungovernable today.
I think the devolution thing speaks maybe more to the ungovernability, because we can accept everything that Hamish has said about the democratic deficit in the House of Lords, but that hasn't prevented Britain from being governable in the past. So not unrelated to that, though, is of course, like, there are always plans for Labour governments anyway to kind of like reform the House of Lords, and they never quite get round to it, with the exception of 25 years ago. So a really good question is, like, what's the principle for devolution? Well, since the devolution settlement of 25 years ago, the principle has been like, well, who asks for it? And sometimes, so it's kind of like devolution on demand, but it does create a rather lopsided polity. And this is like an ungainly phrase, but, you know, the United Kingdom is a plurinational, asymmetrically devolved union state, right? So it's kind of slightly odd.
It's not just ungovernable, it's unsayable.
Unsayable, yeah. There's no elegant way of saying that. So, yes, like, the Scots were really into it. It was clearly needed back in Northern Ireland. People in London had some sort of sense, you know. But whether the people of Cambridge and Peterborough really needed their own devolved assembly is not clear. But I think if Burnham is
but if you lived in the north of England, right, in Manchester, yes, Liverpool, you could rightly claim that Westminster-based government has not represented your interests. And even when they've claimed to, they haven't delivered on them.
Yes, yeah, because there's always, like, you know, the attempts to address the politics of the North have sort of fallen flat for various different reasons.
But that's because of massive change in our industrialised world too. You know, I often think that Britain headed into the Industrial Revolution first, and a lot of things we see happen, you know, the sequencing of them is a guide to where we're all heading one way and the other. And it would just seem to me like Britain's biggest industry has been financial services, and that is where Brexit absolutely undercut financial services. I don't want to blame it for everything, but it has stopped the growth of capital, which you did need in order to give Britain, this post-industrial Britain, the chance to move into a new phase. Now, do you agree with that, Ben?
The British economy has changed so much over the last 40 years that it's shifted away from having a manufacturing base and an extractive base into financial services by and large. And this is partly what has therefore left the northern bits of England and some other parts of Scotland and Wales behind, if we take...
Predictably beleaguered.
Yeah. And this, of course, assumes that the southeast of England and the London financial economy is the norm, right? So we see a lot of that in Burnham's narrative, that this is the end of neoliberalism. Britain took a lot of wrong turns from the 1980s. And in making those claims, I think he's speaking to a lot of opinion in the north of England. And as I say, to some extent in Wales and Scotland, who have now got other parties that speak on behalf of Welsh and Scottish people, complicating the devolved nature of the United Kingdom. And he's really seeking to rebalance that. Now, I think that the city is not especially happy with Brexit, of course. On the other hand, they won't be thrilled that there's a Labour Prime Minister coming in and saying, let's renationalise the railways, let's renationalise British Steel, let's renationalise utilities
the
like Thames Water. Yeah. So, I mean, politically, these are things, particularly the case of Thames Water in the southeast of England, you know, if people can see effluent in their rivers and in their waters and becoming ill, that's a sort of a very immediate thing that the government needs to do something about, and the market-based solution has not worked. So there's a bit of a head of steam around renationalisation. Of course, it's very popular amongst Labour people. So I think Brexit has, you know, in some sense, the Brexit chickens have come home to roost in terms of...
As you say, it was a slow deflation.
A slow deflation.
It's a slow deflation of the economy. It wasn't instant.
No.
Didn't fall off a cliff.
Yeah.
And that's so insidious, isn't it?
Yeah. And it was kind of a scare tactic at Brexit campaign to say, you know, if you vote no, like the very next morning, the bottom's going to fall out of the economy. And of course, it's not going to have that. I mean, very few people were aware of like what was going to be involved in actually leaving the European Union. And it was slightly difficult to see what was going on because, of course, the COVID pandemic followed on, you know, almost like the day after Britain came out of the EU. That kind of scrambled the economy, and then it did all sorts of things like, you know, after the travel restrictions were lifted, there was a spike in immigration, and that's been driving a lot of the kind of radical right politics that we've seen today. And of course, you know, Pauline Hanson's getting mixed up in that too.
You're listening to Global Roaming with me, Geraldine Doogue, delighted to be back, and Hamish McDonald. And we're dissecting the latest political developments out of the UK with Ben Willings from Monash University.
And still to come, we might even talk about Count Binface. Ben, I'm curious to know what you think the influence of Tony Blair is on Andy Burnham, because politically they're quite different. But I was living and working in the UK when he first served as a minister in the Blair government and then the Gordon Brown government. And I reckon when I watch him, people sort of describe him as this very confident, comfortable, gifted politician. Even though the politics are quite different, I really see quite a bit of the Blair messaging and roll the sleeves up, ditch the lectern kind of vibe about the guy.
Yeah. There's a fashion sort of statement, which I call the Tony Blair, which is the shirt tucked into jeans with sleeves rolled up. And, you know, I think...
and yeah, maybe a pair of trainers on.
And a pair of trainers, yeah, like, let's go the whole hog. And of course, like, Blair, if we go back to the point about the value of communication that Geraldine was making, I mean, Blair was terrific at that. Of course, the problem is, for, you know, he's got this very difficult legacy for the Labour Party, because he can remind everyone, as he does, that he won three elections, which is no Labour leader's ever done that. But at the same time, particularly over the Iraq War, he was seen just sort of tacking too close to the neoconservatives in America. So I suppose it would be interesting to see, to go back to Hamish's point, would it be interesting to see if you get Blair's communication skills with different policies, whether that can kind of cut through what is now a very different media environment that politicians have to navigate.
You make a very interesting point in this business of how people speak to lead modern democracies. I think it's such a fascinating story. You say beware of overreach, like Boris Johnson, who had that sort of restored greatness. This is, you know, almost the British Empire is coming back. You know, he was going to come out here to Australia. We were going to be some sort of, I don't know, loose confederation. And in fact, you suggest, and I think you're right, that it actually raises people's hopes and then they're dashed. And so that's a tremendous loss of confidence. So, I mean, getting a measured, proper, appropriate tone is very important. And, you know, even that very first occasion when he was being sworn in to the Commons, Andy Burnham, this is, and somebody called out, a Tory called out, because I watched it. He's not the Messiah, you know, straight out of Life of Brian. Burnham looked, did the signature, and then quickly looked up and said, no, he's just a very naughty boy, which is exactly what happened on the film. It was so clever. And it was a little smile. And I thought, oh, that's not, I know this sounds so sort of, you know, shallow. That's not a bad sign that he's got that, you know, in his quiver.
I think, you know, for the theatre, if you like, of parliamentary prime minister's questions, you've got to have a sharp wit. Johnson was kind of good at that. There are all sorts of things that are problematic about Johnson, but he was kind of funny.
Oh, he was very funny.
Yeah.
But that's all he was.
That's the problem. He was too funny in a sense that people stopped taking him seriously. And so if we imagine, if we go back to, you know, well, what's the ideal way to sort of pitch your message to voters? We could say that Starmer was too negative, Johnson was over-optimistic. So Burnham needs to sort of be somewhere in between those two poles. But I think that this is where, like, the policy offer, you can't sort of paper over the cracks. Let's just go with Hamish's structural problems, because they're certainly there. You can't sort of paper over those really deep cracks simply with some good quips, you know, a cultural reference point that educated people over a certain age will get. What you say is going to be clipped up. It's going to have subtitles put on it. It's going to be consumed in very rapid forms. So it's got to be that the policy offer's got to match the rhetoric. I think that was the problem with Johnson, was that it was like strong on restoring greatness, but at the same time, the structural element was pulling in the other direction. So yes, I think if Burnham is quick-witted, and I suspect he is, that will be good, but he's got to align the narrative with the policies that seem to be making a difference.
And what about him as a strategic thinker? Like, there's this wild by-election happening. Nigel Farage has quit his seat. He's running against a man dressed as a giant bin. What's his name? Count Binface. In many ways, it's the typical populist story, but a very bizarre version of it playing out in the UK right now. Does he have what it takes? Is there any indication that he knows how to meet this moment politically in the broader sense?
If we assume that Farage doesn't lose to Binface, it's not entirely impossible. Or there's about 35 candidates now in that election who are all independents, and they're clearly going to split the Binface vote. So Farage is probably safe. But yeah, what does it take? So basically, the contest is between centre-left and radical right. So what can the centre-left offer that might counter the challenge from the radical right? Because the radical right is very effective at mobilising grievance, and a lot of people are feeling aggrieved. So if you're a Labour strategist, if you're a Burnham strategist, you don't say, let's sound like reform because we'll get our older male voters back in the north of England. You've got to do something that looks and sounds different. And I think you've got to do something that looks like it is addressing a sense of, if I put it this way, it might sound a little bit dramatic, but a sense of disintegration that I think people are feeling. And another kind of like touchstone word here, cohesion, a sense of a lack of cohesion that certain people and certain groups I think are feeling.
Not helped by all those young people out of work or education, that the NEETs, they call it, not involved in education and training. Now, that is a genuine issue.
Yes.
And nobody seemed to have, well, how you draw them back into a future. A lot of these are post-COVID kids and so on. That was quite worrying to hear about.
Yeah. And so these are other kind of structural problems. I think we've spoken about some of the ones that are to do with statecraft and the polity itself, but youth unemployment would be another one. So I think the way to defeat the kind of proposition of the radical right is to address these socioeconomic problems. So actual policies that start to make people feel like their neighbourhoods are cared for, that people are cared for, and that can be, you know, rough sleepers or young unemployed people. That's what's going to, if you like, undercut the offer from the radical right.
Ben, I bet you never thought you'd be on the ABC using the phrase, the independents might split the Binface vote. But there you go. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Ben.
I can retire happy now. Thank you very much.
Job done. Ben Wellings is Associate Professor in Politics and International Relations at Monash University, and his book is English Nationalism and British Disintegration. So, entirely appropriate. Did he persuade you that they were disintegrating, Hamish? You're already on that little train.
Look, I made it pretty clear. I think there's more to that argument about the UK being ungovernable because of those structural issues. I think it's very hard to deliver on a lot of these policy outcomes whilst those remain unresolved. Like, if you just think about the NHS, which the UK is so proud of, and yet the structure for delivering that in Scotland and Wales is different to the rest of England, but it's a national budget. You know, just imagine the complexity of that. Like, there's obvious complexity in Australia and tension between state and federal government, and people argue, well, why do we need all these states? But you can at least understand there's a system, and it may be a bit uneven in the way the GST, for example, is spread out. But you can understand the principle of the federation. And I think when you look at the UK and you think about all of these regions that, for example, voted Brexit, then the way they're represented in the national politics is different to the way other parts of the country are.
Yeah, look, I take your point. I suppose I think that relatively recently, before Brexit, they could manage all this. Yes, there are structural conundrums there, no doubt about it. Mm. But I think it does need very good political capacities.
Sure, but can I just pick you up on that? You could make the argument that they may not have landed where they landed in Brexit, particularly with the north of England, if some of those same principles had applied around devolution
could,
to those parts.
But I think like it's more that, that they, that's why I say, they were deindustrialised and there wasn't yet the ability to imagine new industries, new capital flows up to the north. It was too centred on the south.
But if you look at the government of David Cameron and George Osborne, they made all these huge promises about the north of England, HS2, the rail, various other big investments.
They
just didn't deliver on them, right? And that was the lead up to Brexit.
Yes, it was the lead up to Brexit. Dare I sound very shallow, if a whole lot of young people in London had come out during a bit of a rainstorm, you may not have Brexit. You know, it was terribly close, 51.2 to 49.1, I think it was, you know. So I just think it's really, with England, I think they, I was a bit surprised myself, but it says something, I suppose, about where some Burnham comes from, that he didn't do more of a JFK, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country, you know, step up. Like when you go there, there's a lot that works there. There's a lot in that place that is not falling apart, but they worry incessantly about themselves because they're no longer playing a major role on the world stage. I mean, there's quite a lot in that, you know. They're sort of slightly marooned out there. They've had 200 to 300 years of seeing themselves in a broader way, and they're not now doing that. So I think a lot of that self-perception is quite corrosive in the UK. And the question is whether he's got the capacity to rise above it, you know, with his new Chancellor, John Healey, interesting man. And, of course, in the Foreign Secretary as Ed Miliband, and maybe we'll see more of him out here in Australia. Now, Hamish, I've logged back into the Global Roaming email inbox for the first time in a while, and we have a lot of feedback from your episode with Laura Tingle earlier this week with Tim Watts about a lack of Indonesian language teaching in Australia. I'll just start off with one. Rowan writes, like many, I grow tired of hearing about the importance of our closest neighbours while witnessing a very different reality on the ground. My wife's Indonesian, our children aged 4 and 6 both hold Australian and Indonesian citizenship. We live in Ballarat. There are no government schools offering Indonesian studies. We'd hoped that they, who've spent their entire lives in Indonesia, would be able to continue learning the language. Unfortunately, their skills are slipping, and communicating with their Indonesian grandparents is becoming increasingly difficult.
Anthony writes, if you're not already aware of it, Scott's Head Public School is the only bilingual Indonesian school in the state of New South Wales. You might want to check it out if you're up on the New South Wales mid-north coast sometime.
And Warren says, terima kasih for highlighting this failure of successive governments to do anything about this. Thank you. Perth is closer to Jakarta than Sydney, and many Australians' first overseas holiday is to Bali. Yet school kids, if they're lucky, are still learning French and Italian rather than Indonesian or Mandarin. Will we, our parents, government school systems, ever wake up? Jalan jalan saya.
Yeah, we're going to continue this conversation here on Global Roaming because there is a lot more to say about it and to explore. global.roaming@abc.net.au is our email address. Thanks to our producer, Aston Brown, supervising producer, Pat Sunderland, and executive producer, Laura McAuliffe. Jerry, I'll see you back here Monday. We're talking to Jeremy Dicker and roaming far and wide.
We are indeed. It's lovely to be back, Hamish.
Bye-bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.